Okay, kids. Arnold's is proud to present Kenosha, Wisconsin's own...
This is Orson Welles. Tonight again, our scene is America. America at the turn of the century, in the days that saw the rise, the reign, and the decline of the magnificent Ambersons. The book was a bestseller, but the magnificent Ambersons is something better than that, better than a bestseller that still sells. It lives on as the truest, cruelest picture of the growth of the Middle West, and the liveliest portrait left to us of the people who made it grow. It's better than a good book. It's Booth Tarkington's best.
The Ambersons, literature's most fascinating family, brought to the screen by the magic of Orson Welles. Richard Bennett plays old Major Amberson, tyrannical head of a family that had all the rights of royalty and none of its responsibilities. Dolores Costello returns to the screen with a magnificent portrayal of Isabel, the Major's daughter, who left the man she loved to wed another who was more acceptable. From Citizen Kane, you will remember Agnes Moorehead, who plays thin, spinsterish Aunt Fanny, a lonely woman in a house of wealth. No one would guess that Fanny had a secret love. Ray Collins is Uncle Jack, the black sheep of the Ambersons. Joseph Cotton, who plays Eugene Morgan, the man who came out of the past to find his first love once again. Finally, Isabel's boy, young George, played by Tim Holt, headstrong, impetuous, and arrogant heir to the splendor of the Ambersons. Young George, who hated Eugene Morgan, the man his mother really loved, and stood between their happiness like an avenging angel.
Don't you think you should tell George?
About us?
Yes.
You're not wanted in this house, Mr. Morgan.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Perhaps you'll understand this.
So scandal at last attacked the House of Amberson. Scandal spread by Isabel's own sister. Scandal spread by her own son, who broke into every house in town to make them take back the things they said about his mother. That high and mighty Amberson girl who fell in love just once too often. Magnificent Ambersons brings you many of the Mercury players you first saw in Citizen Kane. It brings you Orson Welles as commentator, director, and producer of a truly distinguished and exciting motion picture.
But before Booth Tarkington's Magnificent Ambersons, here's a message of interest from our sponsors.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women and men and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other .coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has. And never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Mark my words, those automobiles are a fad.
Also joining us this week is videographer Roger L. Ryan.
Very pleased to be here.
This week we're looking at Orson Welles' sophomore film, The Magnificent Ambersons. Released in 1942, the film adapted Booth Tarkington's 1919 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the ascent and decline of an American family in their Midland town at the turn of the century. The fate of the Ambersons is tied to the invention of the automobile. This episode has been long in coming. This is actually kind of a episode that's been in the works for a few years, but we'll talk about that a little bit more down the line. Before we get into the history of the film, which some would say is actually more fascinating than the film itself, let's talk about the movie. It is Orson Welles' second film. Right on after he did Citizen Kane, or a little bit after he did Citizen Kane, he started working on this. And it's the story of the Ambersons and how they kind of come to power in Midland, which is kind of a stand-in for Indianapolis.
It starts out with the telling of you hear a voiceover, which is Orson Welles, and the first thing that you get is him explaining the society in which we're coming into and how things are changing so fast, in that we move through the speed of things. And it's kind of interesting the way he does it, because he uses the fashions of the era in order to do it. So the first image we get with the voiceover is a house and a streetcar, and talks about how in this time of gentility, basically, if a lady called down to the street, they would wait for her to come down and take care of what she needed to take care of. Everything was a little bit more leisurely. Then we get into how fast fashion was changing during these times. Over these maybe 20 or so years, I would say basically kind of like Victorian era, you know, post Civil War to around turn of 1900. And we get the feeling that we're also being told about a certain class of people, which I think really connects Magnificent Ambersons to Kane in a way, is that this, it's sort of a discussion of the American aristocracy, for lack of a better term. It's a certain family, and they have a certain level of prestige and name in this town, and we're guided through as we learn about the young boy, George. We learn about his mother, his father, his grandfather, and the various other things that are connected to them, meaning that this man, Eugene Morgan, played by Joseph Cotton, used to be a suitor of George's mother, and following the death of George's father, reappears on the scene at just about the same time that George becomes interested in Eugene's daughter, although in the first introduction, we don't exactly know that until it's revealed.
I like the way that the characters are kind of introduced in this film, because we see a lot of the characters before we really even know who they are or what their story is. When we first see Joseph Cotton, he's engaging in the different fashions of the day, you know, showing different the different hats that he was wearing. When we first see Major Amberson, he's one of the guys who's wearing an older hat who gets it knocked off of its head with a snowball. When we see Isabel Amberson, she's in the window looking down at Joseph Cotton, and we kind of have this little story about Cotton tripping over this bass viol as he's trying to serenade her. We also even get to see a little bit of Aunt Fanny, who's played by Agnes Moorehead, as one of this kind of chorus of women who are gossiping about the Ambersons. And I like this kind of Greek chorus thing that they have, too, with the people in the town and the way that they talk about the Ambersons. And they kind of tell us more about the Ambersons in this part of it than anybody else, maybe even Welles in his narration. So it's kind of a nice little thing that we have before the story starts proper. We kind of have these glimpses of these characters as they're being led along. And then also the way that Welles is shooting it is this kind of old timey, you know, the edges are kind of blurred, and it's like taking us back to this nostalgic time, which is kind of interesting to me because this is 1941 that he's shooting it. And, you know, the nostalgic time that he's talking about is, you know, 40, 50 years earlier. So it's not like this huge leap in time, but he's using some of the silent film techniques from the teens and 20s to give it this old-timey look.
I've heard it reported that people felt it was Welles playing a little joke by having Agnes Moorehead appear in the Greek chorus early in the film, as if, you know, she's playing two different roles in the movie. But in fact, of course, that is Fanny, because at that point, she is simply Wilbur Minifer's sister. She is not part of the Ambersons clan. It's not until Isabel marries Wilbur that Fanny is invited to come live with the family. And that really sets up the dynamics of that character throughout the film. Fanny is torn in a way. She doesn't necessarily feel like she's part of the aristocracy of the Ambersons. But at the same time, she is, you know, she's been removed from just the common townsfolk. You know, it's repeated throughout the film how her friendship with Mrs. Johnson, who's just one of the townspeople, how that affects the perception of the relationship between Eugene and Isabel. You know, the gossip and everything, she hears it, you know, because she's obviously still friends with the people who would make such gossip.
So in that opening part, we get introduced to Georgie Minifer, who will be played by Tim Holt, but he's played by a child actor before that. And we get to see what a brat young Georgie is, that his mother has foisted all this attention upon him. She doesn't really love her husband that much because he's just this kind of a wet noodle. So she really pays all of her attention to Georgie, and he kind of becomes a little bit of a monster because of it. The townspeople are really looking for him to have his comeuppance.
His what?
His comeuppance. Something's bound to take him down someday. I only want to be that.
They're like kind of lying in wait for him quite a bit. And they, you know, there are discussions about like, oh, well, when he goes to school, he'll get the stuff knocked out of him. And he comes back. And unfortunately for the town, he hasn't had the stuffing knocked out of him. If anything, he seems like he's a little bit even more arrogant when he comes back. And that's kind of our real introduction to George Minifer, being played by Tim Holt at this time. And we get properly introduced to everyone else in the cast via a ball at the Amberson Mansion. A very, very lush ball, beautifully shot kind of thing as we go through. And as Rob was saying, there's this kind of mistaken identity thing going on where George is meeting Lucy and kind of, I won't say flirting, because it seems like he is just kind of strutting around like a peacock a little bit. He keeps ripping on Eugene and calling him a queer duck, and not knowing that Eugene Morgan is Lucy's father. And I kind of love that reveal that they have.
Look here, who sent you those flowers you keep making such a fuss over?
Lucy.
He did.
Who's he?
The queer looking duck.
I've come for that dance.
Oh, him. I suppose he's some old widower. Some old widower.
Yes, he is a widower. I ought to have told you before. He's my father.
Oh, well, that's a horse on me. If I'd known he was your...
This is our dance. Better guess of what it says, daughter.
George, dear, are you enjoying the party?
Yes, Mother, very much. Will you please excuse us? Miss Morgan?
Yeah, it's really interesting, that reveal, because at first, you get the feeling that Tim Holt's character thinks that, well, not only is he an odd duck, but he's like some sort of cradle robber, you know, because he's
right.
Her flowers. So it was like, huh? It's kind of an implied sort of oddness. And then he goes, oh, it's my father. And then he's like, oh, okay. But you don't get this, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize kind of thing. He just kind of continues on and really doesn't change too much in terms of his feeling about the odd duck of Eugene, at least during the ball. He tries to soften a little bit, but mostly just kind of focuses his attention more onto her as opposed to talking about, you know, Eugene. So it's more about, so what about you, and can we go out tomorrow, and all this.
And this section of the film is very, very layered when it comes to the dialogue. Throughout the film, we're really going to get Wells's radio experience coming into play, just with the way that the dialogue is presented to us and the way that the soundtrack works. But I think especially in this time, we're seeing that really come to the fore, where we are getting so much information. And it's all coming at once, and really the way that people are talking and things are being overlaid and stuff. I mean, reading the script of this, at times it was a little confusing, just because you would get all of these different characters just kind of giving a few words here and there, and it's building and building and building the story, even though it's not in one cohesive, you know, narrative line. And I like the way that we kind of move from this character to another character, and the way that we are getting the story told to us in this, to me, it's a rather fascinating way.
It is rather much based on the ensemble. I mean, the whole story, and we'll get into it later as to why I have my problems with it, but I think that that's really one of its strengths, and I also think possibly one of its weaknesses, is that it has this tendency to float from person to person, and we're not given one person to really connect with, and the only person that we really spend a decent amount of time to connect with is the George character, and he's not really all that likable at times.
Though this is the time where we could kind of have our allegiances with Eugene Morgan, and especially after the dance, we go with him and we kind of follow along with him and Lucy, who's played by Ann Baxter, in Eugene's kind of prototype car.
Papa, you think George is terribly
Miller. Oh, he's still only a boy. Plenty of fine stuff in him. Can't help but be. He's Isabel Amberson's son.
You liked her pretty well once, I guess, Papa.
Do still.
One of the things Wells is doing is he's using the model of the automobiles to let you know that the time period is changing. Certainly, you're meant to recognize that the automobile changes by the time the last ball is occurring and Eugene and Lucy are driving home. You'll later see that car in the factory scene when the camera is tracking away from it to reveal the new model. And the characters even comment on it. So now you realize, oh, even more time has passed. And so that's a continuing motif throughout the film. I think at this point they start pretty much establishing the idea that Eugene, who is widowed, is back in town. And he's very cautiously and, I guess, you know, we would say secretly courting Isabel, but he's obviously not doing it while she's married. And what ends up happening is Wilbur Minifer dies prematurely. And Eugene, in a sense, sees that this is his opening to possibly rekindle the old romance.
I think this is kind of where some of the confusion that I had the first few times that I watched this movie came into play. The whole idea of Eugene ostensibly is kind of courting two women at once. You know, he's got Aunt Fanny, who he really kind of, and I put this in air quotes, should be courting because she is unmarried. And then he really, though, wants Isabel. And there's this conflict that's going on that is, I won't say it's unspoken in the film, but it's not as broadly broadcast as it might have been in other ways. And I definitely picked it up more when I was reading the book. I mean, in there it was fairly clear, but seeing it in the film, it took me a long time before I realized that, you know, he's seeing Fanny and Isabel at the same time and basically bringing Fanny along almost for appearances. And I don't know how much of that she realizes or even kind of puts up with just to have time with Eugene, but he really has no interest in her whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. I'm absolutely convinced that Fanny knows that it's a one-sided attraction. There's no point, I think, in the film at all where it's implied that Eugene has any interest in Fanny. It's always, usually you're hearing about this from the Uncle Jack character, who is telling you how silly Fanny is, you know, presenting herself over Eugene. And I think it's clear from her very kind of neurotic small talk and everything she says, she realizes she's the third wheel, that she shouldn't be there. But again, she desires to have some kind of identity as apart from being Wilbur Minifer's sister.
And that's really kind of what sets her off. You mentioned the death of Wilbur Minifer is after he dies, there's really no reason for her to stick around. I mean, there's the, you know, being George's aunt kind of thing, and there's plenty of room in the Amberson mansion. But with Wilbur out of the picture...
Wilbur Minifer. Quiet man. Town will hardly know he's gone.
She's kind of there, and I think that's really kind of what sets her off in one of her first fits, and we see her engage in several fits throughout the film.
Oh, Aunt Fanny.
Oh, Fanny, we were only teasing.
Oh, let me alone.
Please, Fanny.
We didn't mean anything.
Let go of me. Please.
We didn't know you got so sensitive as all this.
Quite a bit of the cutting was done because audiences responded poorly to Fanny, specifically to, I mean, Morehead's performance. Everyone felt, apart from Wells, and I assume Morehead herself, felt that, you know, she was too over the top in a number of scenes. We won't know, obviously, but my feeling is that people were uncomfortable with the unsympathetic portrayal. And I think this is true of Fanny, and I think it's true of Tim Holt's performance as George to some extent, that they didn't like this idea of spending so much time with unlikable people. That's where the drama is. I mean, you know, Fanny is not going to be a suitable match for Eugene because she's an emotional wreck. I think the payoff for Moorhead's performance in this fashion is probably found in that in the final scene of the film that was cut, which is the boarding house scene. I think that's the payoff for everything you've seen in Fanny up to that point. But, you know, that's I can only speculate on that.
I think Agnes Moorhead does a great job in here. I mean, she had a very small role in Citizen Kane as Kane's mother, and does a great job with about the 2 minutes of screen time that she has in Citizen Kane. But in here, does a fantastic job. And when I read that she had been nominated for an Oscar for this role, I was like, that was a good choice, because she is quite good in here. I think some of the performances are quite excellent. I think, you know, Joseph Cotten does a great job as well, and several of the other actors. But I really think that she is a standout in here in terms of the film.
So we have kind of this dual courtship going on between Georgie and Lucy, and then also Isabel and Eugene. And then, as you mentioned, we have Uncle Jack, who's played by Ray Collins there. And we have a little bit of Major Amberson, even though I would say that Major Amberson really doesn't play a huge role in this film. He feels like, you know, he's just kind of he's the patriarch and everything, but a lot of his stuff seemed to have ended up on the cutting room floor as well. I mean, there are some nice scenes with Jack and the major in a – are they in a car or a carriage?
They're in a carriage, and about half of that scene was cut, the last half, which, I would agree that I think Richard Bennett's performance as Major Amberson, a lot of that hit the cutting room floor, which I think is a real shame because, again, I think he's giving a very real performance. Now, that reality of that performance could be possibly due to just the actor himself having trouble remembering his lines, but there's something that creates something very real about that. There's a wonderful little moment in the last ball scene where the camera is pulled back to reveal a punch bowl, and Major Amberson is asking Eugene if he wants some punch, and the characters are talking, and Richard Bennett crosses behind them, and you can tell that he's looking for his mark on the floor. That, you know, that it, the shot, again, it's been truncated, and it had been going for probably a good minute or so before it even got to him, and he doesn't want to screw it up. And so you can tell he's looking for his mark, and he walks, and he looks down, and then he lifts his head up, and he makes it part of the character. It's kind of a weird, distracted look, and it fits perfectly with who the major is. Despite the fact that you've lost so much footage from him, his final scene where he's ruminating in front of the fireplace is one of the most amazing moments, I think, on film, period.
I think it's also, I would say, maybe a testament to Wells himself, because if you look at Kane and this as well, it seems that Orson Welles, for a guy who's in his 20s, understood old people. Like, if you look at how, you know, especially in Kane, where he himself plays a man who gets older and understanding sort of like movement of old people and how they do things, I think that just sort of adds to it. I mean, he just had this ability to pull this out, to get actors who were, you know, 20, 30 years younger and make them older. Not to say that the gentleman who plays Major Amberson was, you know, 25, because I don't think he was. But he just has that ability, and I think he does a really good job with that in both films.
Well, I think he definitely knew how to surround himself with very talented people, both actors and technicians and everything. And I think that's definitely one of his strengths when it comes to all of his films, but especially these early ones, you know, working with Toland and Kane and working with his cinematographer, plurals, on Amberson's, and just the actors that he's chosen and everything. Even young Tim Holt, I will say, you know, he isn't that pleasant of a character, but I have to say he is giving one hell of a performance in here, because I've seen him in other things where, you know, he does a really good job, but I don't think I've ever seen him give a performance as nuanced as he did as Georgie Amberson, Minifer.
Probably Holt's performance is the thing that turns people off the most. If they're going to have a problem with Amberson's, they tend to point to his performance. But I think he's doing exactly what Wells wanted him to do. You know, when you spend enough time, I guess, you know, rewatching the film or understanding what the original intentions were behind it, you start to see really the subtle changes that occur within that character. And certainly I think the recutting of the film and the resequencing of the film for the released version unsettles that. There's an important scene that occurs far too late in the sequencing, which is supposed to come earlier, which puts everything that comes after in a different relief. When you recognize how the film was originally structured, you start to see the more nuanced changes in George's behavior, actually.
At some point, Georgie really starts to realize that Mr. Morgan has interests in his mother. And having had his father pass away within the last not quite a year, he's really kind of put out that his mother would – I think that's kind of the excuse he uses anyway, is that his mother hasn't had her proper time of mourning and is afraid that people will start to talk about the family and if she does anything with Eugene before that year is up. But really, I think it's just that he is very, very jealous of Eugene Morgan and very protective, overprotective of his mother. And really, that's one of the big conflicts in the film, is between Georgie and Eugene. And in that case, I'm definitely on Eugene's side. But we have Georgie really starting to trash Eugene in subtle and not so subtle ways. I mean, we've already talked about how he called him a queer duck before he even knew who he was. But then afterwards, we get him. I think the most pointed scene for that is at a dinner when George comes out and talks about how useless the automobile is.
Gene, what's this I hear about someone else opening up a horseless carriage shop somewhere out in the suburbs?
I suppose they'll drive you out of business, or else the two of you will get together and drive all the rest of us off of the street.
Well, we'll even things up by making the streets bigger. Automobiles will carry our streets clear out to the county line.
Well, I hope you're wrong, because if people go to moving that far, real estate values here in the old residence part of town will be stretched pretty thin.
So your devilish machines are going to ruin all your old friends, eh, Gene? Do you really think they're going to change the face of the land?
They're already doing it, Major, and it can't be stopped.
Automobiles are a useless nuisance. What did you say, George?
I said automobiles are a useless nuisance. Never amount to anything but a nuisance, and they had no business to be invented.
Of course, you forget Mr. Morgan makes them. Also did his share in inventing them. If you weren't so thoughtless, he might think you rather offensive.
I'm not sure George is wrong about automobiles. With all their speed forward, they may be a step backward in civilization. It may be that they won't add to the beauty of the world or the life of men's souls. I'm not sure. But automobiles have come. And almost all outward things are going to be different because of what they bring. They're going to alter war, and they're going to alter peace. And I think men's minds are going to be changed in subtle ways because of automobiles. And it may be that George is right. Maybe that in 10 or 20 years from now, if we can see the inward change in men by that time, I shouldn't be able to defend the gasoline engine, but would have to agree with George that automobiles had no business to be invented.
The great thing, to the credit of the character of Eugene, played by Joseph Cotten, is that during the whole time that he's being slammed by George Miniver, he always is very nice, you know, and is even willing to talk about the question of the automobile. That, yes, indeed, it may lead to some changes and some problems, you know, that we may not even know right now. He's very much a gentleman. I mean, he's not someone to use this, I'm an adult, you're a kid kind of, you know, looking down my nose at you kind of thing, or try to play that kind of role that I think you would see in lesser written characters, where they would take these affronts and shove them back at them harder.
It really hits an important theme that's happening in Ambersons. George, as an Amberson, and the Amberson family, their wealth is based on land ownership. It's old money to some extent. What ends up happening with the Industrial Revolution and the coming of the automobile is that their land literally becomes less valuable because people start moving further out to the suburbs, the real estate values start dropping. So the wealth is being eroded. And this is an important motivation for George, is he doesn't know what his future is going to be. He recognizes that the wealth is slipping away, and he doesn't know, you know, what path he should take. So not only does he have this situation where Eugene is apparently courting his mother, but he sees Eugene as the enemy, in as much as his invention of the automobile is going to basically erode the wealth of the family away.
You're going to take away his power on all fronts. The undivided attention that his mother gives to him, even when his father was around, he was this angel to her, and now to have someone else come into that picture. But yeah, also to have someone who might be eroding that wealth. And really, George is just such a layabout when it comes to his motivations. I mean, from the first time that we get him talking with Lucy, and how when he's out at college, he's studying a lot of useless guff, and that he wants to be a yachtsman. That is his goal in life. And it's just like, you know, no motivation whatsoever. He just expects everything to be handed to him. And the scene that I mentioned a little bit earlier, as far as the major and Uncle Jack talking, and, you know, him saying that he thinks that George must think that he's made out of gold. And it's like, Yeah, George is really good at spending other people's money, and that seems to be his real skill in life.
I like the fact that he wants to be a yachtsman, but he's from a landlocked state. You know, when we talk about this whole thing about the automobile and how it's going to change a city, I don't think we've seen that in Detroit at all. I think that, you know, it's been exactly the opposite. I think more people are moving into the city, not out to the suburbs. You know, yeah, none of that happened. Yeah. That's the thing that's interesting watching this through the eyes of a Detroiter, is you often think to yourself, did Henry Ford have these conversations at dinner with people, you know, around the turn of the century in our fair city?
Yeah. And was he, you know, blaming everything on the Jews or not?
Yeah. I didn't see Eugene sending goons after his workers when they tried to form a union. But then again, we didn't get that far along, did we?
Well, that's one of the real attribute of the film Ambersons, is that Eugene, certainly as performed by Joseph Cotten, is extremely charming. And yet his character is still flawed to some extent, in that he doesn't recognize the damage that he's doing. He's shown to be stubborn to some extent, although most of the time he's very congenial. But I would say he's romantic to a fault. And not to keep jumping ahead here, but I think the payoff for that was Wells's original boarding house ending, in which he believes the right thing to do is to go visit Fanny, and he's going to make everything all right because he feels that everything has a happy ending. What he discovers is that he couldn't be more mistaken about what his relationship is with the Amberson family.
He's too polite. You know, he doesn't give it back to George at this dinner scene. And when George then turns around and casts Eugene out of the house a few scenes later and refuses to let him see his mother, let Eugene see Isabel, he just walks away. And that's the worst, the saddest part of the film, is him being turned away again. I mean, there is so much of this film that has Eugene Morgan, Joseph Cotten, standing in doorways, basically being barred entrance from the Amberson mansion. And it's just, I want to see him kick down the door and go storming up to Isabel's room, maybe, you know, throw down on the ground and make dirty love to her. But, you know, that's not going to happen. Eugene is way too nice and does not ever turn his sights on George. I think the closest that he comes is later on in the film when he writes a very pointed letter to Isabel. And that's about as close as we come to him having an outburst. And I don't know if it's this whole, like, era of manners, and I believe that it is. I believe that, you know, we are living in this world, you know, that Wells set up for us within the first few minutes of us being in the Magnificent Ambersons, and that is a world where passions are being controlled for the most part, though George is kind of out of control, but the passion is being controlled, and we're not going to get Eugene saying what he wants and doing what he wants and taking what he deserves.
It does come out of, obviously it's America, but it does come out of that Victorian era sensibility, which, you know, the story starts and you have someone like Eugene who would have grown up in the late 1800s. And of course, that was more locked down than someone who's 20, 25 years younger, I guess, is what you would say in the case of the George character. So it's this contrast of generations that's in there, and also sort of that cusp there where we talk about, you know, America moving into modernity and at the same time trying to keep up these appearances of what sort of gentle society was all about at that time.
Also, to some extent, and I think this goes along with the idea that Eugene is just, you know, a nice guy, and certainly he's represented as somebody who was just an ordinary guy from the town who managed to do really well in business and is elevating his position. But in one of the cut scenes from the last ball, or one of the moments from the last ball that was cut, you really get the sense that Eugene refuses to think poorly of George. His Uncle Jack, you know, is kind of referring to him as the tin god on wheels, and kind of trying to let Eugene know that this kid's, you know, spoiled rotten. And Eugene won't hear it, you know, in his mind, as long if Isabel loves her boy, her boy is loyal to Isabel, that's fine by him. He takes a long time to get angry over over the rebuffing.
Tell me, what do people in this town think about young George, generally?
Well, a lot of people that are glad to express their opinions about him quite strongly, too.
Yes? What's the matter with it, Fred?
Too much Amberson, I suppose, for one thing. And for another, Isabel just fell down and worshipped him from the day he was born. I don't see how she doesn't see the truth about that boy of hers. She thinks he's a little tin god on wheels. I tell you, Jean, she actually sits and worships him. You can hear it in her voice when she speaks to him. You can see it in her eyes when she looks at him. My heavens, I often wonder, what does she see when she looks at him?
Yes, well, she sees something that we don't see.
What?
An angel.
Tell me, Jean, when you met George tonight, did you see an angel?
No. All I saw was a remarkably good-looking fool boy with the pride of Satan and a set of nice new drawing-room manners. No, Fred, mothers see the angel in us because the angel is there. And mothers are always right.
Yes, I know what you mean, Jean. You mean that George's mother is always right.
I'm afraid she's always been.
She was wrong once, old fellow. At least so it seemed to me.
No.
I also think, too, is this not only this generational aspect, but like you were saying, he was just this guy from the town who happened to get ahead based on his wits and his business acumen. And I think that that also is a different thing, because before that era, you know, America was much more European before we get into the modern era, where it was about family and what a family name meant and things like that. I mean, that's very old European kind of sensibility, you know, that I'm Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die kind of attitude. That's not America. Like, here, your name really doesn't mean anything. It's all about what you do individually. And sort of this old aristocracy idea that, in a lot of ways, the George character is really trying to hold on to, because it's really all he has. If he doesn't have a career and he doesn't have his own way of doing things and he can't really set himself up on his own wits, then all he really has is the name Ambersons, which really isn't even his name. You know, it's, he is of the family lineage, yes, but you know, he's an Amberson, but he's not at the same time, and he still wants to what that means. He still wants to be part of what that means, and that's why that's so valuable to him.
It's treated like a little a joke in the film. Even you'll have characters who say, "Ah, Mr. Amberson," I mean Mr. Minifer, because of course it's not actually his name, but Isabel Amberson is always more important than the man she married. You know, that's a running theme through the film.
And that Amberson Boulevard at the end gets stripped of its name and just becomes, what, 10th Street. It's like, yeah, I mean, even the family name has been declined so much that it is taken off of the street signs. You know, that is, we really that is the moment where we know that they have lost everything. And that's one of the few things that, you know, kind of sticks around when it comes to the decline of the Ambersons, because really that's so much of what gets lost. You know, we see and we understand while we're watching this film that things aren't necessarily going as well for the Ambersons as it might have, but not in the fashion that originally was crafted. We get a lot of things that are kind of missing to show. Well, one, I think passage of time. There's a lot of problems when it comes to showing passage of time with the film. And then two is the decline of the Ambersons. We're not getting nearly as much of that. Getting back into the story a little bit. So I mentioned that Eugene is turned away from the Amberson mansion. Georgie kind of steals his mother away and takes her over to Europe. And back at home, we are getting conversations about what's going on with Isabel. And she finally comes back into the country and is incredibly weak. While she was away, her health really took a turn for the worse, even though she wasn't the most healthy person around. And Eugene comes back to that door, tries to get up and see Isabel, and he makes it inside, but he's turned away again and cannot see her. And that, to me, is the most heartbreaking part of the film.
Just the idea that even that now George has the ability to control it even more, that he didn't like Eugene, he can keep Eugene away. And especially at the time when, you know, really, what's the harm? You know, if she is going to die, it's like it would be nice for people to get a chance to be a comfort and, you know, and have those moments. But it just shows how even more selfish he is. I mean, it's not selfish enough to spend the money and be a brat, but to be that selfish in terms of, I guess maybe it's more of a existentialist selfishness. It's like you can't even, you know, you control your own life, you're going to go control someone else's too.
Why would George insist that Eugene not be there? And I think it just, again, comes down to he sees Eugene, he sees the Morgans as enemies, because we have to keep in mind before he left for Europe, he had a lovely little walk with Lucy, and she basically put him in his place and infuriated him. And so he's not only angry at Eugene, he's angry at Lucy. And so I think he's acting out by preventing Eugene from seeing the dying Isabel because of his feelings for Lucy. He wants to get back at her. But I would agree that, you know, that moment where he's with the dying Isabel, and she asks if Eugene has been there. And interestingly, you would think almost that George would not tell her the truth and tell her, no, he didn't come. But in fact, he doesn't want to lie to her. And so he says, yes, he was here. And then she delivers her last line, which is, oh, I would have liked to have seen him just once. You know, that's a line that's going to haunt George now for, you know, the rest of his life.
I love that shot, the shot of her in the bed. And that kind of almost like a spider web kind of thing going over her face and shadow, and just the beauty of that mise en scène is just, I love the way that looks. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful shots in Magnificent Ambersons, but I think that is one of the most beautiful ones.
And I would say that the following shot, again, it's been shortened for the release version, but if I had to point to one moment in any of Wells's films that I think is absolutely an example of his genius, I would say it's the following shot that begins on Major Amberson, who's fitfully trying to sleep. He wakes up, the camera pulls away from him, and there's this kind of confusion where you see Uncle Jack come from frame left, and he literally bumps into George and into Fanny as Fanny enters the room. It's very confusing. Fanny grabs hold of George and just says, she loved you. She loved you. And it fades out. And you know that it means that Isabella's died. Just within a few seconds, it perfectly captures that sense of waiting around for the inevitable, of that sense of what do you do when you know someone's going to die? You know, you just kind of stand around in each other's company. And then just that kind of confusion of what do you say? And it's just a very subtle, very beautiful moment. I would point to that as, you know, that's Orson Welles at his best right there.
And it's very shortly thereafter that the Major passes in a very interesting scene where we have him talking about the way that the Earth came out of the Sun and we came out of the Earth. And that's pretty much his final words. And I like that we even don't hear his all of his final words, that we kind of fade out as he is talking, and just to kind of signify that he's passing into this other world, as it were. And I think that we kind of, again, I was talking about the condensing of time. I think there's supposed to be more time happening there, or we're supposed to know that more time has happened, but it almost seems like a 1-2 kind of thing between Isabel and the Major. Also, we kind of miss, I mean, there's a little bit of it, but we really kind of miss the whole importance of the Major never having deeded the house to Isabel, and basically, without that, George has no kind of claim on the house. And then when the Major dies, that's it. The family is out.
Certainly, almost everything related to the financial problems of the Ambersons has been cut from the film. And it's layered in there very early on. During the Snow Ride sequence, it's referenced to. It's referenced again when George comes home from college. It happens throughout the film, and you get so little of it, and so you're not really sure. Well, what happened to the to the family? Why are they in such dire straits? But in fact, the scene with the Major was again longer in Wells's original edit. Basically, you're watching the Major's face while you're hearing the other members of the family talking. And the information they're giving you is that you've learned that Fanny, who has invested all of her money in a headlight company, has lost it all. And so you understand that there's a problem there. That you're given the information that the deed can't be found. And all of that's very important to understand the final third of the film. Because of the financial situation, they're losing the mansion. Jack is able to get a position at a consulship. He's going to be leaving the family, and the idea is he's going to try to, earn some money and possibly send some money back to the family. But at this point, George and Fanny are going to have to move out of the mansion, and they're looking into renting a room at a boarding house. It's at this point where in the release version of the film, there's a sequencing change where they change the order of these final scenes. And I think it disturbs the way you're supposed to view the series of events. To start off with the train station sequence, which shows Uncle Jack getting ready to leave, the first half of the scene has been cut out. And in the first half of the scene, he's asking George for money because he simply doesn't have it. And George has a little bit left, and George gives him the money. In fact, George says, "I wish you'd take more." And so, you're starting to see a different George here. This scene originally was followed by a scene in which George walks home through the town from the train station back to the Amberson mansion. And it's this very disturbing, eerie montage, a series of dissolves showing just the buildings that are falling apart, factories that have been built up. A lot of dirt and grime and poverty, basically.
George Amberson Minifer walked homeward slowly through what seemed to be the strange streets of a strange city. For the town was growing and changing. It was heaving up in the middle incredibly. It was spreading incredibly. And as it heaved and spread, it befouled itself and darkened its sky. This was the last walk home he was ever to take up National Avenue to Amberson Addition and the big old house at the foot of Amberson Boulevard. Tomorrow they were to move out. Tomorrow everything would be gone.
George reaches home to the Ambersons, and again, another shot that I would love if it was in the release version is a matte shot of the Amberson mansion. As he approaches, and you can see that the mansion has been neglected. It's deteriorated. He goes inside. He walks through the mansion, and you realize that much of the furniture has already been sold. And he goes to Isabel's bedroom, and he kneels at the bed, and he says,
"Mother, forgive me. forgive me. God, forgive me.
Wells does this beautiful narrative passage in which he talks about the fact that George has now received his comeuppance that the townspeople had wished for so many years earlier. It's at this point where the change has now occurred with George. The following scene is George trying to console Fanny, who is having a complete mental breakdown in the kitchen. And he's telling her that they do not have enough money to afford the boarding house that she wants to live at. So he goes to an old nemesis of his, a character named Roger Bronson. And Bronson has been trying to help him possibly get an apprenticeship with a legal firm. And George says, I have to have something quicker that'll pay from the start. And he says, I understand they pay high wages to people who work with dangerous chemicals in a dynamite factory. Basically, what you're to realize is that George here is willing to do some really nasty stuff to make money. And it's not for him, it's for his aunt. This scene is then followed by a sequence in between Eugene and Lucy, in which they discuss in metaphorical terms the plight of the Ambersons and of George in particular. And Lucy tells it like it's a Native American tale about a proud chief who walked over people and so forth. And Eugene, of course, realizes that she's talking metaphorically about George and about the Ambersons, but he kind of teases her about it. But this scene is then followed by an accident scene in which, in fact, George has not been hurt at a dynamite factory, but has been run over by an automobile, which, of course, is the grand irony of the whole story. And that leads us into what was, and now you've got two different endings. You know, you've got the Wells original ending, and you've got an ending that exists in the release film, as you can see now, that was reshot.
So let's stick to the release version, where we've got Fanny and Eugene showing up at the hospital where Georgie is after he had his accident. And it is one of the most schmaltzy scenes that I've ever seen. Just those two talking that George is going to be okay, and Eugene talking about how when he was in the hospital room with George, he felt like there was another presence there, that it was Isabel kind of looking down and approving that George was there with Eugene, or Eugene was there with George, and telling Fanny about that, and them kind of smiling and walking out, and, you know, the music swelling, and just feeling like it has been completely tacked on. I mean, the style is completely different when it comes to that ending, and it's so abrupt to me. It's like, what, really? This is the end? You know, it just, I don't know. It really does not do a whole lot for me.
Yeah, that ending is about as bad as what we talked about on the Coffin Joe episode, where they tacked on the ending in the final 30 seconds of the second Coffin Joe film, where it's like, oh, I've seen the light. Yes, Jesus is, you know, great. And it's like, no, it's not as abrupt as that, but it's pretty bad. The thing that's interesting is when you get into the other version of the film, the remake, is how different the ending is. So since I haven't read or seen what the original plan was for Ambersons, I'm sure it was definitely not that, as we definitely know it wasn't.
You are listening to the Campbell Playhouse presentation of The Magnificent Ambersons. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Christopher Wells, author of In My Father's Shadow.
I think Ambersons is a unique film among my father's work because, first of all, it's the only film of the features that he completed where he doesn't have a part in it, you know? He is not a major actor in that film. And if you think of all his other films, he definitely has the main role usually, right? But in Ambersons, he's only the narrator. Now, that's already interesting because here he is, he's the narrator, and he's taking us by the hand and leading us back to a lost world, basically. The antebellum world of before the automobile, you know, when people lived, there was elegance and there was more leisure, And so the opening of Amberson's, I think, is so marvelous because we just hear his voice, and he's recreating this whole world for us in the opening scenes, which are definitely his footage. You know, they didn't monkey with anything in the first few reels of the film. And yes, I think in a way he is evoking his own childhood because he grew up, he grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and his father had a hotel in, I think, Decatur, Illinois, where he spent many summers when he was a boy. And so he was in touch with that world that we see in The Magnificent Ambersons, and I think he was trying to bring it back for us. And so in that sense, there is a lot of nostalgia, I think, in this film.
Peter Bogdanovich.
The narrator that you played in, so to speak, in Ambersons, it has the quality of, you know, the sort of the storyteller, the man who's telling the story for
That's
everybody
right.
to hear.
That's right. And I like that for movies.
Oh, it's great.
And supposed
but nobody
to be,
ever does it.
No, and I wanted to do more. As I say, I have never had a chance to, and I'd like to.
And it's supposed to be uncinematic.
I know, it's a great, that's a yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a great, it's one of the cliches of, but that if you, the narration is uncinematic, nonsense.
Were you deliberately looking for something in which you wouldn't appear?
Yes.
Why was that?
I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done it. I was obsessed in my hot youth with the idea that I would not be a star. That I would only incidentally play great roles. Now, there's no such thing as incidentally playing great roles, because you're not going to get them offered to you or anything. And I was in a position to promote myself as a star, and I should have. I should have gone back to New York and played Hamlet, and as long as it was going, I didn't. I had this idea that I wanted to be known as a director, and that was it.
A persistent theme is how money and power corrupts. You know, we see this in Citizen Kane, and then in the Shakespeare films, you know, he picks films where Macbeth is undone by his ambition, Othello is undone by his jealousy, you know, and on and on. And what's unique about the Ambersons is that instead of dealing with the folly of human nature, you know, we're dealing with the onset of the industrial age, the invention of the automobile, and how that completely destroyed the world as they knew it. That, I think, that's what fascinated my father about the Booth Tarkington novel on which this film is based. And I think he himself had a great nostalgia for the world that we see in the film before the industrial age, before factories, before cars, you know, that kind of wonderful world that he evokes for us in the opening scenes of The Magnificent Ambersons.
It's a marvelous book, and Tarkington, I think, is an extraordinary writer who is must be discovered again, because he did write some things that are not so much sentimental as dated in their attitudes. He's disappeared.
Yes,
but he
very out of fashion.
But he deserves to be taken much more seriously than he is. A great, if Ambersons the movie has any quality, a great.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.